This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Good morning. So alongside human and political consequences, the conflict in the Middle East continues to impact markets. As the conflict started, we hosted a webinar at the beginning of this month, and we looked at the escalation in the Middle East and picked up topics including energy market disruption, inflation, government bond yields, and also explored signals that could prompt material changes to portfolio positioning. 2 weeks on, we continue to see the conflict dominating headlines, but also impacting markets. Some observers had perhaps expected the conflict to have settled quickly, but today a quick resolution does not appear to be on the horizon. So today, we want to again consider our views on market conditions and outlook, and importantly, how we manage risk, focusing on how we can support our clients in meeting their long-term objectives in this notable geopolitical moment. I'm really pleased to be joined by three of my colleagues this morning. So we've got Chris Jeffrey, co-head of asset allocation and head of macro, Ben Bennett, our chief investment strategist based in Asia, and Raza Agar, head of emerging market sovereign strategy. So good morning to all of you, and thank you very much for joining me. So first of all, I'll go to you, Ben, and I've got a couple of questions wrapped into one. So how significant have the market impacts been so far? Where have the biggest moves been, and have any of them surprised you?
I'd say that the overall market moves have been relatively modest, actually. Well, let's start with the ones that have been bigger, and it starts with oil. I'm going to talk about market moves from the start of March to yesterday's close. So that'll be the 19th of March. Oil, so Brent's, for example, and that's in the headlines, of course, it is up 50% over that period. So about $108 is where it closed yesterday per barrel. You know, natural gas in Europe, the price there has doubled as well. So these are big moves. US contracts have been less badly impacted so far. And I guess that's, you know, to do with the supply, where the supply has been disrupted and the US is a little bit less exposed there. So those oil prices then feed into inflation expectations, don't they? And then that has led to an increase in interest rates. So short-term government bond yields have gone up quite a lot. US treasuries, two-year US treasury yields are up 0.4%. That's quite a lot. Now in the UK, there's been a bigger move. Two-year UK gilts, those yields are up nearly 1%, sort of 0.9% is what they've gone up. So that's a big move. It's been less of an increase longer down the curve. So 10-year yields up as well, but a little bit less. Treasuries about 0.3%, gilts 0.5%. So about half as much as they were at the shorter end of the curve. The other things that I think is interesting, that the dollar has rallied on the back of this move, the conflict, and that's a classic risk-off effect. So the dollar and the DXY index is up about 2%, but gold hasn't rallied. So gold previously would be expected to be a risk-off asset class. It's actually down about 12% over this period, and that just shows you perhaps that some of the gold moves that we saw earlier this year or late last year might have been a bit of speculation going on there. And then when you go to equity markets, yeah, they are lower. The S&P is down 4%, the FTSE is down 8%. But again, these are massive moves, and these are still quite close to all-time highs. And then finally, on credit spreads, investment grade US credit spreads are up 3 basis points, which is very little at all. High yield up 19 basis points. Again, you drill into these moves and you will find bigger moves. But and of course, when you add the underlying government bond yield move, then overall yields have moved a fair bit. But yeah, not a huge amount. But you know, if you worry that this is going, we're going to talk about it, if you worry that this is going to continue and potentially get worse, there are still lots of opportunities to reduce risk. If you're worried about that, you could reduce equity risk, you could reduce credit risk. In some of our portfolios, we've reduced a bit of credit risk and we've increased our liquidity positions. Just if it gets worse, then that gives you some opportunities down the road. If you have liquidity, if you don't have liquidity, you can be a bit stuck. So that's broadly the range. The final thing I'd say is that we have reduced a little bit of our government bond exposure just because, as I said before, government bonds really haven't been your friend during this period. Government bond yields have gone up at the same time as we've seen the correction in risky asset classes.
Thanks, Ben. There's lots of stats, but some really interesting ones in there. I think you talk about the oil and the natural gas. I think the surprise, perhaps, maybe gold. I think you spoke about that being down 12%, whereas perhaps normally in such market conditions, you might expect that to rise. So kind of, but you also use the word modest, which is interesting. And kind of, and we'll talk later on about actually kind of opportunities to protect the risk. So how can investors best position themselves through this volatility? So, Chris, Ben did go there and he spoke about inflation, which I think is incredibly important. And it's very much top of people's minds. And we've seen some good moves in market inflation expectations. We've had several central bank meetings coming up. Indeed, we've just had one. So are the rate cut expectations now looking too optimistic in the markets?
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many rate cut expectations left in the markets after the course of the last couple of weeks. One by one, seemingly across the G10, we've seen the market shift from pricing cuts to pricing hikes. Kind of started with Australia delivering a rate hike last week. We've had a thicket of central bank meetings this week, from Japan to Europe to the UK to the US. And the message from all of them has been one of kind of wait and see, rather than the central banks, which were previously guiding towards rate cuts. The wait and see, I think, is colored by the recent memory of 2022. So the central bankers have a regret minimization objective. The regret that they're trying to minimize at the moment is a repeat of that episode when inflation got out of hand, inflation expectations got out of hand, and they were forced to adjust sharply and later than was ideal. In the UK, Ben's already alluded to this, in the UK you've had some of the biggest moves. We were at one point earlier in the year pricing three cuts from the Bank of England. This year we now price three hikes. It doesn't mean that those hikes are likely, just as the cuts weren't delivered. It doesn't mean that the hikes are going to be delivered. The way that I kind of think about this really is there's like a monetary policy equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath. Above all, do no harm. And what they will try to do, they will try to sit this out and look for the second round effects in wages, in core prices. Now, they may come through or they may not come through, but it is a wait and see process. So if you ask me, am I convinced that we'll get those three hikes this year? I'd say no, I don't think that's my central expectation, but it's impossible to be particularly definitive about it because it depends what happens in natural gas markets and oil price markets. So there's clearly a scenario where the Bank of England are pushed into delivering that with implications across the whole of the UK curve. But I think you should see those as just as likely as the three cuts that were priced in at one point earlier in the year.
Okay, love it. Thanks. Thank you. And I think that wait and see approach, definitely the moment, I think there is probably too much uncertainty or questions. And when you talk about scenario planning, lots of different ranges which one could go towards. And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit later this morning. So Roz, I'm very keen to bring you into the conversation with your emerging markets expertise hat on. So let's go back a little bit and talk about the backdrop for emerging markets before the start of the conflict. And perhaps you can talk about that and also tell us what's changed.
Thanks, Laura. It's a good morning to everyone. Generally speaking, emerging markets entered this crisis in a relatively strong position. Growth dynamics had been resilient with the 2026 forecast above the 4% mark for the fifth consecutive year. And that's higher than pre-COVID levels. In the external sector, current accounts are still positive with resilient trade surpluses at an aggregate level. Strong remittances, tourism flows, and record levels of issuance all helping. Now, these surpluses, coupled with rising gold prices, meant foreign exchange reserves with EM, including or excluding the large reserve holders, were at record levels. And just to give you a sense of the buffers that these reserves provide, at the end of last year, total reserves in emerging markets were nearly three times the level of external debt payments due over the next 12 months. So clearly no risks of a systemic crisis. And all these positives were being reflected in rating upgrades, outpacing downgrades for 27 consecutive months into February this year. And sovereign defaults being zero for the last two consecutive years. So as a result, EM sovereign balance sheets are well positioned to deal with the fallout of this conflict. Now, as to what's changed, I think, as both Ben and Chris have alluded to, one of the direct channels of impacts is via inflation, and that's, you know, due to commodity prices for energy, for fertilizers and chemicals, all of which are inputs into, you know, agri sectors and then the industrial production in most emerging markets. So all else equal, if there's a sustained increase in commodity prices, that will filter through to external balances, weakening them, and hence impacting exchange rate weakness as well, which then just compounds the impact of higher commodity prices on inflation. I'll also say that exchange rates are also vulnerable to weaker risk appetite, you know, at a time when positioning in local markets, in EM local markets, was quite long on the back of 11 consecutive months of inflows amounting to nearly $25 billion in the asset class since the middle of last year. So, if the conflict sustains, and depending on the central bank's reaction function that Chris talked about, we're also seeing that in EM. If this sustains, this will translate into higher rates, which will impact the growth outlook. And I think the other point, the final point that I'll make is higher commodities could well also result in wider than currently expected budget deficits in many countries and or a drawdown of sovereign assets.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Ross. I mean, so much in there. And it sounds like actually the positioning was good. You were very optimistic. And again, similar to some of the other speakers, we're talking about a little bit of a wait and see. There's definitely some vulnerabilities perhaps at the moment, but something to be considerate of and think about it in a quite a informed way about outlook and what that means going forward. Now, we can't ignore the theme, and all of you have spoken about it when you speak about commodity prices. It is very much dominating the news from an institutional investor perspective, but also perhaps people just day to day thinking about what it means. And I think oil tends to be the one that is top of most people's minds. Let's go back, Chris. I appreciate we've got listeners from various geographies. So we're not just talking about the UK, but if we just quickly turn to the UK and we think about those recent movements and gilt yields that we've spoken about, how much of that has to do with the oil price relative to perhaps some of the other structural features of the market? So trying to bring together some of these themes we've been talking about.
Yeah, so I'd say actually most of it's got to do with the gas price rather than the oil price. So the headlines out of Qatar clearly in the last 48 hours or so also implying kind of potential long-term disruption to the gas market. And the structure of the UK's electricity market is very dependent on gas, that we are unusual in developed economies in having an electricity market which is so dependent on gas for setting the marginal price. So that transmission from high gas prices to high electricity prices to high levels of inflation overall, because you can't really do a great deal or make a great deal without electricity, is why you've seen the biggest fundamental move in the UK. The government, faced with that kind of gas shock, has one of two choices. They can either kind of let it pass through, that pushes up inflation, or they can choose to subsidize it. That implies a fiscal cost and pushes up issuance. I mean, neither are great news for the gilt market. I would say, though, that had been the catalyst, and then the setup of the market partly explained why we've had such a big reaction. And I want to be really clear here, the setup is totally different from 2022. This is not a story of the long end of the market and the real yield, so the inflation-linked bond market, driving the volatility. That was the story in 2022. The biggest moves were in long-dated inflation-linked bonds. Today, it's all been driven by the short end. There's been that radical repricing of the outlook for the Bank of England. Investors have probably got a little bit ahead of themselves in hope and anticipation of cuts, so positioning for cuts to be delivered as inflation came down. That positioning has kind of collided with the reality of much higher gas and oil prices. So that commodity move, I think, has been the trigger. And then the catalyst really is that positioning setup. But I do think it's really important to note that this isn't a story of kind of leverage unwinding, driving kind of systematic problems, structural problems in the long end of the market. It's a much more traditional repricing of the rates outlook at the front end and then that rippling through.
Perfect. Thanks, Chris. And thanks for the clarification that we're talking here about commodity markets generally, albeit it does always seem to be oil dominating. But actually, the clarification of the impacts on the UK is really important. And also good to hear you kind of stressing that this is short end. We're very different from 2022. So going back to what Ben was talking about at the beginning about how this is kind of short end of the curve where we're seeing the greatest moves. So I'm keen to go back rather now that we've taken that sidestep and we've looked a little bit about the commodity market, is to go back to kind of you with your emerging market hat on and talk about how you're positioning within the AMD team at the moment in what is probably, I think it's fair to say, a little bit more of a complex environment.
So the EM team went into the conflict underweight the Middle East region because we saw elevated conflict risk as not being reflected in regional valuations amidst record levels of issuance from countries in close proximity to the conflict. Our overall beta was also relatively modest and declining on the back of valuations in EMD. And even within the beta that we were running, our core positions were and are in almost exclusively in credits where we see value on a sustained basis, whether that's driven by domestic reform efforts or their commodity endowments or where you have multilateral support from agencies like the IMF, which provides a policy anchor for investors. So the onset of the war therefore meant that we didn't need to make huge changes in the portfolio positioning, but rather more tactical ones. And so we used market dynamics to partially cover underweights in some of the lower rated names or have added to credits we like due to their fundamentals as valuations have become more attractive selectively. But we are very cautious in our approach and only gradually scaling into the buys or the sells, largely because this is a market that is very technical and trading headlines with very little firm conviction in the outcome. I'll also say that since the conflict, we have also implemented hedges using CDS and local currencies to reflect significant uncertainties around the outlook. But that work, that the positions we have in local markets or local currencies rather, are based on bottom up credit analysis.
Perfect. So I think that hopefully listeners will take comfort that's cautious, that you have the experts there looking at what is more technical and maybe a little bit more of a difficult market to understand. But actually, I think the caution that you're showing and taking where you do take positions, doing it in a very deliberate and informed manner is really important. So we did speak, Chris, at the beginning, we were kind of doing the introduction, thinking about what people are going to be or listeners might be thinking about now. So we are a couple of weeks in. The market volatility is perhaps still there, although some of the moves that kind of really use your word, Ben, modest. But if people are concerned about market volatility, and Ben did touch on this, what options do investors have and kind of are there arguments for and against trying to mitigate potential downside and taking a different view?
So I'm going to say that there's kind of two categories of things that conceptually people might be thinking about doing in this environment. So one is, so the first kind of category would be, there's a strategy or trade that I've been wanting to do for a long time and I've held off from doing, and the current market environment gives me an opportunity to do that at a better price. So that would be kind of an example. I think Raza talked about taking advantage of market dynamics to do things that were kind of more structural. So in this category, by the sell-off in gilt yield has pushed 20-year yields back to the highs. For those who are kind of under-hedged or light on duration risk, the market has just given you the best price to be buying 20-year gilts in the last 6 months. And that is that's potentially interesting. Now, that doesn't apply on the inflation link side, but it does apply on the nominal side. That would be quite a kind of typically a kind of UK DB pension fund specific thing to be thinking about, but that would be one. One that would be much more universal would be on currency markets. I think one of the conversations that we've had with our clients a lot, I know Ben's been having a lot in Asia, is the conversation about de-dollarization and dollar dominance in global portfolios. There's been a nervousness about actually doing anything about reducing dollar exposure because it's been so persistently weak for the last 6 months. That's suddenly not true anymore. So those two things are in the category of, you know, there's a strategy, but then more directly to your question on kind of on hedging and protection, I'd make a couple of points. So Ben's already mentioned the equity markets are off their highs, but not dramatically so. So, I mean, let's say 5% in US equities. The price of option protection has risen, as you would expect in a period of heightened volatility, but it's not eye-watering. So we've seen nothing like the kind of, you know, repricing that characterized the 2022 shock or the 2020 COVID shock. The MSCI World in sterling terms is still only down around 2% year to date. So for people who are, you know, fundamentally nervous about what this crisis portends, then either directly reducing equity exposure is still only going to be 2% off where you were at the start of the year on that metric, buying the equity protection, it's roughly twice the price at the start of the year, but it's still not eye-watering. And then one that has been talked about a couple of times already on gold prices. It is interesting that gold has not played that safe haven role. You know, people who want to take that gold exposure as a kind of hedge against different types of crisis. Obviously, there's gold miners as a leverage play on that, which are, again, kind of offering more opportune pricing than has been the case for some time. You can kind of draw a story where you can kind of rationalize some of the gold selling that's happened. You know, some of the largest gold holders are reserve holders. Reserve holders in the Middle East have other priorities than adding to their gold exposure at the moment. But again, when gold prices have been weak like this and people have been kind of looking to add gold exposure for a long time, this is kind of an interesting time. And then the only kind of final thing I'd talk about would be credit. Brad has kind of already talked about the kind of strategies that they're deploying in the END fund. But I guess in principle, you'd be looking for credit exposure, which is light on duration and tightly manages its credit risk in situations like that. That makes you think of kind of special situations type strategies or kind of unconstrained bond type strategies.
Thanks, Chris. I mean, some really good ideas or kind of thought pieces for people to kind of consider, perhaps with advisors in terms of some of the options that could be available. So we have, I'm going to go slightly off piece, team. I've had a question that's come in. So one of you can choose to answer this first. So a couple of you have spoken about this as the short-term kind of part of the curve versus 2022 when the issue was much more of the long-term market. So the question is, when the conflict finishes, what could be the effect taken, given it will take years to rebuild all the infrastructure that's been damaged?
I think there's an interesting point here more broadly about post-COVID and post the conflict in Ukraine and what we're seeing here about a diversification of everything, really. So thinking about diversification of supply lines, diversification of assets, because no longer can you trust the world order prior, you know, what it used to be, the sort of liberal democracies. And that requirement to diversify often leads to structurally higher inflation, potentially, because you're not quite as efficient, are you, when you're having to do things that you didn't want to do. So my answer would be, yeah, this inflation that we've seen that was called transitory, wasn't it, back in post-COVID, it certainly isn't transitory. And I suspect that a lot of these things are linked to that. And therefore, you should expect potentially for inflation to be higher structurally going forward.
So Chris has given us some good insight about kind of through that risk mitigation, but perhaps in developed markets, which is very much the hat that he's wearing. So how do you contrast that if we dig a little bit deeper into the END side? How can investors manage risks which are coming from these developments when you're thinking about it from the emerging markets perspective?
Yes, I think, you know, the short answer is by ensuring that portfolios are well diversified, both regionally and in terms of whether countries that you're invested in are importers or exporters of the commodities facing supply constraints. And like I said, like we're doing, it's also prudent to use hedges in the form of credit default swaps and perhaps even currencies based on, like I said, rigorous bottom-up analysis. And again, you know, just to emphasize that point, given the uncertainties, it's always prudent that any changes you do in positioning should be in a gradual and considered manner. Now, At a broader level within emerging markets, the lower rated credits in the immediate vicinity of the conflict and many in Asia are more exposed to the potential fallout of the conflict, and not just because of higher commodity prices, but also due to the impact on the supply of commodities like oil, gas, fertilizers, and chemicals. But what I will say is that many of these credits have very strong buffers, and that's highlighted in their investment grade ratings that have sustained for years. Where we are monitoring more closely is the lower rated and sub-investment grade names, both in the Middle East and in Asia, as they tend to have smaller fiscal and external space to be able to deal with the sort of exogenous shocks that we're looking at. Conversely, what I'll say is, I mean, countries that are exporters of the commodities that are seeing price increases and supply constraints, and you can find them in sub-Saharan Africa, you can find them in Latin America, they're going to see larger trade surpluses. And as a final point, I would also argue that in uncertain times, well-anchored stories, whether due to domestic reform efforts, whether due to their commodity endowments or because they have IMF support programs that give you policy anchors, they will be much more sought after.
Perfect. Thank you. And so I'm going to come back to that when I do the conclusion of some of the phrases that you use, which I think are incredibly important. So Ben, if I may, I'm going to come to my last question of this morning to you. I can't believe we've not said the word China today. So how vulnerable are the Asian countries to these higher energy costs? Because that's definitely been the theme of our discussion in the last half an hour. And I'm asking you this because you're based out there. You're based in Asia, so you kind of see this day to day, don't you?
That's right, yeah. I live in Hong Kong. So yeah, it's normally when I get asked a question about Asia, my starting point is, look, it's so varied and so diverse that you can't bucket Asia into any one discussion. But in this case, actually, Asia is extremely, as a whole, vulnerable to oil and natural gas out of the Straits of Hormuz. It's about 80% of the supply out of that strait goes to Asia. So in this instance, unfortunately, there's a lot of exposure. The four big countries, big economies, so China, Japan, India, South Korea, yeah, they get a lot of their energy from this region. I think a lot of people have said in the past, and it's still true today, that as long as there is a resolution in a relatively short number of days, potentially weeks, then a lot of the impact on the economy is relatively mild. But if it lasts for several weeks, months, then there is a serious situation developing in terms of shortages of things. It's not just the price, it's literally the shortages. But of course, when we talk about Asia, your question is about China at the beginning, because it's the biggest, second biggest economy in the world, and it supplies huge amounts of manufacture for everywhere else. So it's really important there. China is exposed, but it does have a decent stock of reserves, much more than, for example, India and South Korea. So I think in that sense, there is at least some comfort that China can weather this. Now, with China, the issue is that the economy is very exposed to exports. That's how they're making their money right now. The domestic Chinese economy has been relatively weak because the property sector has collapsed. So they need to have that trade. They need to be able to sell stuff. So they need to... Yeah, they need this situation resolved in order to be able to make sure that they can continue to be that manufacturing, that trading powerhouse. If the global economy suffers significantly over the next few months, China would be very sensitive to that because they wouldn't be able to sell as much as they had before. So it's okay for now. But yeah, as with everything, this is an extremely sensitive, difficult situation where we've got to be very vigilant. And
okay, thanks, Ben. And I think it's a good position for maybe me to pull this together. So we've taken a look maybe at that more regional basis and kind of the developed and also the emerging markets, but also that global view that you've given and kind of the impact that this could have. We're not saying it will, but the impact that could perhaps come on the horizon. So I'm going to refer to my bit of paper. I've been taking words as you go through the presentation to bring this together. So thank you very much, Ben Rosa and Chris, for kind of joining this morning. I think what are some of the themes that I've heard? So I've heard the importance of diversification. I think that always continues to be important for investors. I've heard us use the word proportionate about thinking about actually the scale of the market moves and what that means for investors today. And I love the phrase that you use, Raza. You talked about the gradual and considerate manner in which to make decisions in the current market environments. There are options for risk mitigation should investors be nervous, but actually also what I've heard is they're perhaps unique to each investor on an individual basis. So I think it's something that people can consider. So I'd like to thank you all again very much for your time. And I will conclude in just saying that many of us do know people in the region that have been directly impacted by the conflict. And we really hope that everybody that we know, perhaps it be clients, families or colleagues or others, do remain safe and can return to normality as soon as possible. And thank you very much for your time. And should you have any questions post this webinar, then we'd be very happy to help. Take care.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LG Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.